skies today, highs in the low 60s. For tonight, lows around 43. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs will be in the upper 50s. And for tomorrow night, the lows will be near 42. It's currently 53 degrees. The relative humidity is 80%. Winds are out of the west at 12 miles per hour. And remember, Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive is underway. You can contribute online at WPR.org or you can call 1-888-202-2552. I'm Steve Brown, and this is WGTD News.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I feel profoundly honored and grateful for the opportunity to speak on today's morning show with a woman by the name of Elsa Hunnison. She is a deaf-blind activist and has written extensively on her experience of being blind and deaf, and about the way in which we construct the world around us in such a way that makes life more difficult, more complicated than it otherwise needs to be for those who might be blind or deaf or both. And Elsa Hunnison's book is a very, very persuasive and illuminating account of what her life experience has been and the ways in which we can change the world around us to make it indeed more truly accessible. Elsa Hunnison does not just write in terms of her own activism and her own life's experience, but is also a very fine speculative fiction writer and, in fact, is a 2-time Hugo Award winner. So
three now.
Oh, three. Pardon me. I'm behind the times. Well, congrats on that. And the book at hand that we're talking about today, which is about to be re-released in paperback, is called Being Seen: One Deaf Blind Woman's Fight to End Ableism. It's published by Simon Element. And Elsa Hunnison, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
I'm really grateful for this opportunity. I have learned a tremendous amount already from reading your book, which I've not had the opportunity actually to even quite finish. But I really appreciate all that is there. It might be helpful at the outset for us to give our listeners some context in terms of your own disability. And maybe one thing that we can talk about even ahead of that is a choice which you use in your book, that is to use IFL, Identity First Language, versus PFL, Person First Language. And that's an interesting choice. You are sure to point it out to us because it's probably a choice that some people will find surprising. First of all, explain that distinction those two different ways of talking about this and why you have chosen identity-first language in your book.
So identity-first language is when you say a disabled person or a blind person or a deaf person. And PFL, person-first language, is when you say people with disabilities or people with blindness or people with deafness. Part of that decision is because identity-first language is the language that I use on a daily basis. And part of that is because I want people to get really comfortable with centering a disabled body and not to try and hide behind the disability. A lot of people use person-first language to, and this is a literal quote, remind people that a disabled person is still a person. And when you start to think about it that way, it starts to put a slightly bad taste in my mouth, at least, that you have to remember I'm a person first rather than just recognizing that I'm a disabled person. The other reason I do it is because if you start to think about it in other marginalized communities, you don't say people with gayness, you say gay people. And so I want people to remember that they get to have the identity that they live with. Their body and their identity gets to be centered, and they're still people.
At one point, as you're talking about this, you say, my disability does define the borders of my life. That's not a bad thing. It just is. I think what you're saying there is, in a sense, we shouldn't be afraid of certain kind of language or using it in a way that will really clearly explain, in a sense, who we are and the nature of what our life is like. And it sounds like this choice is one way that you think most effectively does that, at least for you.
It does. And Lawrence Carter Long, who's an excellent scholar on disability, has the hashtag Say the Word campaign, which has gone on for years to ask people to center the word disabled just for that reason. The other reason why I think it's important to acknowledge that my body has limits is that everybody has choice sets based on their body. My choice set means that I can't drive, although I did try to drive in the book and it didn't go well. But I have a choice set. My choice set says that, yes, I can do ballet. I can do swing dancing. I can ski. I can fence. Maybe a non-disabled person's choice set doesn't allow them to do those things, but they can do other things that I can't do. Everybody, whether it is disabled or non-disabled, does have choice sets and definitions based on what it can do. So to want to tell me I can't be defined by my disability is kind of silly if everybody is defined by their body and its limitations.
Right. I'm curious, how much pushback have you received from others in the blind deaf community over this choice of language?
Absolutely none.
Huh. So in a sense, chances are it is well-meaning bystanders who have set in place the widespread use of PFL, whereas it is those in the blind deaf community themselves might not in a sense see that as a necessary or even helpful thing.
I think it's a combination of things. Non-disabled people are real uncomfortable with acknowledging my disability and would really prefer that I didn't talk about it. So they'll be the ones who'll be like, oh, but you're not that blind, or you're not that deaf, or but you're not disabled. That's what non-disabled people say to me. There are disabled people who use person-first language, and if that is a choice that they choose to make, they're welcome to. That's their comfort level. That's what they want. But I find that most of the disabled people or people with disabilities that I know who've made that choice are ones that also see that I am making a choice for myself that they respect. So the disabled people are not the ones who are going to tell me I can't use that language. It's the non-disabled people who do.
Hmm. And as you say time and time again, disability is not a bad word. And it is a word that you want all of us to become comfortable with, in part because all of us are, at some point in our lives are going to experience some disability ourselves. As if we're blessed to live into old age, that's one of the things that almost certainly is going to happen to us, to all of us.
Yes, and one of the things I want to remind your listeners is if they're benefiting from the use of glasses or contacts, they do experience disability. It's at a very low level. They're not necessarily experiencing disability in the same way that I do, but hearing it, glasses and contacts are adaptive aids. They're just extremely common ones.
So let's talk about the nature of your own disability, which, if I understand correctly, springs from something called CRS, congenital rubella syndrome, the fact that your mother experienced rubella or German measles during pregnancy. And evidently, CRS can, and certainly in your case, can cause a whole host of various symptoms and results. What are those when it comes to you and your own body?
So CRS is a disease that affects, well, it's syndrome that affects people who were born after their mothers had rubella when they were in utero between the first and second trimester. And those two trimesters, typically, the conditions that the babies then have are very different. I don't remember when my mother had it, but doesn't really matter. There's a common trifecta when it comes to CRS, and that's hearing loss, vision loss, and a heart defect. I was born with all three. My heart is fine now. My cardiologist mostly just wants me to take care of myself and to exercise like everybody else on the planet. But when I was an infant, I did have to have heart surgery to correct a defect. I was also born with bilateral hearing loss. I do wear bilateral hearing aids now. And I was born with cataracts in both eyes. They were able to remove one of the cataracts, but not the other one. So I do have vision in one eye. But the vision in my one eye is not great, and certainly does not provide me with the same visual experience as a sighted person. I wear glasses. They're very thick. They're much less thick than they were in the 1990s. It no longer looks like there's an inch of glass in between my eye and the rest of the world. But I do have the full trifecta when it comes to CRS. And there are other conditions that show up that you may not know about. But I like to refer to my condition as a little bit of a Pandora's box in my own body. You don't quite know whether something is related to CRS or if it's just your aging or if it's just something weird happened. Mm. I have a left hip that likes to dislocate for no particularly good reason. It always has. And they think it was CRS that did that, but they don't know.
Mm. I think at one point in the book you talk about, aside from that central trifecta, as you called it, you make mention of also mysterious little oddities that crop up at the most inconvenient times. And certainly I'm sure that that situation with your hip would be among them. I guess this
is.
And I guess this helps us understand one thing about why then you would say it took me a long time to understand how to live in my body. And another point in the first chapter, you say, I've learned how to survive in a body that wasn't intended for the world I live in. I imagine that is, in a sense, a lifelong endeavor to not only to learn the basics, but then to learn better and better how to function in the world given the limitations of your body.
It absolutely is. It's a daily practice. You learn the basics because you have to. If you don't learn how to stop and listen for cars, and if you can't hear the cars, then you have to wait until one literally physically stops at the crosswalks you can cross. Two little things like I can tell where stairs are based on shadows because I don't have any depth perception, so I can't see stairs. But it's also things like my children. I now have children. They wear brightly colored coats so that I can see them at 50 feet away in the Seattle fog. And other parents have literally said to me, oh, that's a really good idea. I should try that. But it's just my way of adapting. It's the way that I look at the world and change to make sure I can do everything that I need to do. But the fact is, the world doesn't want me to do that. The institutionalization of disabled people did not end very long ago. And that includes that my parents were told to institutionalize me. So I wasn't supposed to be out in the world. I was supposed to sit somewhere quietly for the rest of my life. Adapting in that environment is about survival, and it's also about self-preservation. So I've had to pick up everything mostly on my own with the help of some orientation and mobility specialists. But it's a lifelong practice of figuring out what works and what doesn't. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Elsa Hunnison, who is the author of a book called Being Seen, One Deaf Blind Woman's Fight to End Ableism. As we've already talked, because your mother experienced rubella or German measles at some point during pregnancy, the result was CRS or congenital rubella syndrome, which, among other things, gave you partial blindness, partial deafness. One of the things you talk about in your book is the intriguing choice that your parents made. That is, I think you say it at one point, your parents chose to raise you in non-disabled society. So in other words, they were not enrolling you in special classes. They didn't teach you Braille. They didn't teach you sign language and so on. They, in a sense, kind of threw you into the deep end of the pool and wanted you to just kind of start swimming and functioning as fully as possible in the world. First of all, tell us what you understand and to what extent your parents even have explained to you this choice that they made, a choice that at a glance might seem like a perfectly defensible choice, but one with which you now take serious exception.
Well, I want to be clear, and I said this in the book as well, that my parents didn't have a lot of choices. The 90s were still the beginning of the ADA, and so inclusion in schools was not as good as it could have been. So I recognize that my parents didn't have all the best choices. But I think that they made these choices because they wanted me to be as non-disabled as possible. That was definitely the trend at the time. But I do take exception because I still could have learned Braille while still being in a mainstream classroom. I still could have learned American Sign Language in a mainstream classroom. It may not have been in the classroom. It may have been at home. It may have been with private tutors. But having access to the deaf community, having access to those skills, would have been immensely helpful as I grew up. And I think they made that choice in some ways out of fear. They didn't want me to be labeled as the disabled kid. They didn't want me to think differently about myself. And I have empathy for that. I don't judge my parents. I have criticisms for them, but I think everybody has criticisms for their parents when they grow up. It's just that my criticisms happen to be in print.
To what extent did you have long conversations with them about this?
Well, my father passed away in 1993, so I only have his papers where he's written about what it was like to raise a disabled kid and how he felt about being my parents. I don't have a lot of information on his experience or his thought process. And I've talked to my mother about it. But it's a difficult conversation to have. And I don't want to say too much about that because I think for her they were private conversations.
Sure.
But I can say that I think the philosophy that I have come to embrace as a disabled adult sometimes brings her discomfort. Mm-hmm. And so I think that from my perspective, I think she still feels justified in her choices. And I feel like it's possible to say maybe I could have done better if I had had different tools.
One thing you mention in your book, and I so appreciate that you say this because I'm not sure a lot of us, in a sense, from the outside looking in, would be aware of this, is that at least in many, many cases, what is available to a person who is living with blindness or deafness what is available to them and the way that they are perceived and accepted and so on and encouraged is very different when they reach the age of 18. And in particular, that certain things that were on hand and there as guides and tools and so on vanish when that threshold of 18 is reached. Tell us more about what you are talking about and to what extent you, in a sense, missed this because you didn't have those tools at a young age anyway. But, I mean, for most people who do, what happens at the age of 18?
Well, I did experience it to some extent. Washington state law requires that insurance companies cover hearing aids for children and has done so since the 1990s. So my hearing aids were completely covered by insurance when I was a child. And the minute that I turned 18, that was no longer the case. Now, I wasn't wearing hearing aids between the ages of about 13 and 20, roughly. But that was because I experienced extreme bullying for wearing them. So when I went to go and get my first set of hearing aids after the age of 18, I was shocked to find out that my insurance wouldn't cover them, that I had to pay for them out of pocket, and that hearing aids were as expensive as a, you know, car payment. They're not cheap. And so I was really surprised by that. But I know that this has happened to other people on a much more severe scale. People with intellectual disability, like intellectually disabled people, many people with physical disabilities that make it difficult to get up out of their beds. When they turn 18, what happens is that they lose their rights as adults. They go into what's called a conservatorship or a guardianship, and they don't have the right to make decisions for themselves or in some states even vote. I had the opportunity to vote at 18. There are disabled people who are my peers who did not. And this also goes into marriage equality. Marriage is something that is barred to people that receive Social Security. You get that Social Security when you're a kid, but you don't when you're an adult. If you continue to get it as an adult, you can't access things like marriage, because if you are married to somebody who makes above a certain threshold of money, you're no longer allowed to get Social Security, which you may need, or Medicaid, which you absolutely need if you have certain disabilities. So that aging out harms people on a variety of spectrums of disability on a variety of levels.
We're speaking with Elsa Hunnison about her book, Being Seen, One Deaf Blind Woman's Fight to End Ableism. As she says at one point in her book, I have lived a life of defiance. I want to circle back to something I intended to ask you towards the top, and but this is as good a time as any, I think, to talk about what you wanted this book to be, and in a sense, what you did not want this book to be. It's a really intriguing moment when you say a lot of disability memoirs are about making non-disabled people feel inspired by a disabled person's life journey. This is not that book. If you walk away inspired, I'll feel that I have not done my job correctly. So explain to our listeners what would be so bad about them reading your book and walking away inspired. What other goal do you have in mind with your book, Being Seen?
Well, if you walk away inspired from this book, what you're looking at is putting me on a pedestal and saying, oh, she's deafblind and she's done these things, and I, a non-disabled person, have not. And if you're doing that, what you're saying is that I, a disabled person, have somehow done better than you, and because of that disability, you have to catch up. And that's not how it works. I have a master's degree. That's great. Not everybody needs to get a master's degree. And certainly you shouldn't look at a deafblind person and say, oh, if she can do it, I can do it. Because don't put yourself through academia just because I got a master's. You should do it because that's what you want to do. Using disabled people on pedestals to make yourself feel like you can do something actually undercuts that we did it. And in addition, if you look at I Am Not Your Inspiration, Please, you can Google it. It's a speech by an Australian disability activist who sadly passed away a few years ago. She talks about why it's such a problem. But being inspiring sort of undercuts our own accomplishments. It also makes you, a non-disabled person, feel better about yourselves, and that doesn't help us either. So what I'm actually asking people to do when they put down Being Seen and they walk away from the book is not to be inspired, but to be changed. I want people to change the way that they look at disability. Instead of saying, oh, wow, she's deafblind and she can do fencing, I should do that, I've never tried it, I'd like you to think about the actual things that you want to do that you've never done, that maybe you could do, that are within your own choice set. And I want you to think about the people around you who are different and think about the fact that they are people. Because at the end of this book, that's what I'm saying. I'm a person just exactly like you are. My body is just different.
And, of course, you also do say at this point in the book, talking about what you want this book to, how you want it to affect readers, you said also you should be inspired to dismantle the ableist system we live in. I mean, if you want to be inspired by something, be inspired to do that, not to take up
100%.
Fencing. 100%.
Because ableism will affect everyone at some point in their life. I especially want to highlight that in light of COVID-19, because people who are not were not disabled recently are now experiencing long COVID symptoms. COVID is disabling people at a massive rate. This is a mass disabling event. And if we don't undo ableism and start to really force our society to change, to become more accessible, we're not just undercutting the disabled people who have always been there, but all of these new disabled people who have no idea what they've just gotten into. And our response to the pandemic itself has been ableist. The idea that non-disabled people feel comfortable just taking off their masks when disabled people have been asking people to please continue wearing them to keep them safe so they too can re-enter society, that's an ableist action. And so I want people to really reevaluate what their priorities are, whether they want to continue to live in a world where disabled people are shut out, or if they want to live in a world where it's inclusive.
You mentioned the fact, you mentioned COVID, and that's something which props up in your book because it is a significant chapter in your own life story. You had something really quite frightening occur early in 2020 as COVID pandemic was descending on all of us, but of course in a very, very serious way in Seattle, where you were living at the time. And well, explain to our listeners, I think you'll say it better than I, what you experienced during that COVID pandemic, which changed your life so drastically.
Well, the first thing is that I moved to Seattle just as the pandemic started, and I actually had COVID within my first 3 weeks of being there, which was terrifying. And I didn't know that I had it until months later when I described the illness I had had to my doctor. And her response was, oh, yes, you had COVID, and also now you have long COVID. It took me 18 months to recover my lung function. So don't mess around with it. It's scary. It's bad. But I think you're referring to April of 2020 when every single one of my adaptive devices failed on me. And we were living in a very different world in April of 2020. So my guide dog, who is now retired, he had issues with one of his hind legs. He pulled a muscle and he was not able to work. My hearing aid died. In fact, what happened was that the receiver got stuck in my ear, so I was no longer able to use either of them. On top of that, my white cane broke. And because the hearing aid center wasn't available for in-person appointments, and because my guide dog just needed to be on bed rest, and because I also couldn't hear very well out of my ear because there was a receiver stuck in it, for the first time in a very long time, I was without any adaptive aids whatsoever. And it was really frightening because I've learned to adapt using those tools. Without them, I'm a very different person. And on top of all that, because I'm deaf, all of these people were now wearing masks. All of these people were now behind plexiglass walls at the grocery store. I wasn't able to hear people about the total of my grocery order. I wasn't able to hear people when I picked up a coffee at the one coffee shop that was around the corner from my house. And so I recognized that I had to make changes to my life in order to be more flexible. I needed to learn ASL, which was something I'd always wanted to do, but I just hadn't had the time for it. Oh, look, it's 2020. I have time. I needed to remember how to use a white cane and not just rely on the dog. And that was a good thing because he ended up retiring later in 2020. Those choices were important, but the reminder that my body has a base state of disability that I don't live in often, but that I need to remember how to adapt with, was a profoundly eye-opening state of experience. Knowing how to live in the body without the adaptive devices is just as important as knowing how to live in the adapted body.
I especially appreciated in your book the point at which you describe the first time you began using this the proverbial white cane. If I remember correctly, the year was 2002, and you were 16 years old, and you were about to go off to Oxford University to study Shakespearean acting and British history. So explain to our listeners, first of all, why it was that at this point you were going to be utilizing a white cane for the first time. Why you or someone else deemed it necessary for you to take this particular tool into your life, and just how complicated it is for a white cane to be utilized effectively.
So I was 16 years old. We had just left New York City in 2001. And I had been working New York City without a white cane, and it had been exhausting. I was taking the subway by myself. I was going to high school every day, and I didn't have any adaptive devices, and I knew that that was hard, and I didn't have an adaptive device yet. So when I got accepted to the study abroad program at Oxford, I knew I would be flying by myself to England. I'd never done an international flight by myself before. I'd been to London with my mom, but I hadn't been there for a long period of time. I hadn't been out of the country by myself before, and I recognized that I needed tools. And some of that is because my aunt was also blind. She'd married into the family in the last 2 years before that point, and she had been kind enough over Christmas to let me try using her cane. And I tried it, and I realized that it could be a really useful tool for me. So I went to the now no longer open store for the blind in Seattle that sold white canes with my grandmother, and they gave me my first orientation and mobility lesson. And what I want people to understand about a white cane is that it is not intuitive. You have to learn how to get that information out of the cane, because what it's telling you is ground texture. What it tells you is where there's a bump in the road, or where there's a curb, or where there's stairs. But it's all about the technique and feedback that you use your one hand to get all of that information from in order to make choices about where you walk and where you don't walk, when you take a big step and when you don't. And the cane and its feedback changes depending on your environment. If it snows, I can't get around as well with a cane, and I just have to trust my own 2 feet. If it's super rainy, my cane gets wet, and also it drags in water. It doesn't just smoothly glide across the street. If it's muddy, same thing. It can get stuck. It can also get stuck in big cracks in the pavement, and can occasionally, if you're really not careful or paying attention, fall into a storm drain. That happened to me once. It wasn't fun.
Oh, dear.
It's a tool, but you have to learn how to use it, and you have to experience a lot of different walking conditions to have it work for you perfectly.
I must confess, it had never dawned on me until I read your book that, I mean, I guess just sort of stupidly or naively assumed that what a cane was mostly for is to keep you from running into something you shouldn't run into. But you describe how, for instance, with a cane, if properly used, you can tell that the floor in this room I'm entering is very slippery, or mm-hmm. that it's very bumpy, or whatever it is. But by getting, I think you call them one point, textural cues, I mean, you can end up learning so much about how to safely navigate through that room or over that particular surface that has nothing to do with not running into something. And of course, for the rest of us, that might be completely lost on us. But that's essential for using a white cane well.
It is. And I think it's also important to think about the fact that my biggest danger is not actually running into things. My biggest danger is tripping over things or having other people run into me, because I can't see. I don't have peripheral vision, so I can't see somebody running at me at speed. When I was in the airport yesterday coming home from a trip, somebody just ran straight into me with their suitcase, and I had no idea that they were coming. And if they'd been paying attention, they would have seen the cane and slowed down. But the cane is just as much there for people around me as it is there for me. It's a reminder that I can't see you, and you probably shouldn't get mad at me if I run into you.
You also tell us quite a lot about what it is like to navigate through the world with a guide dog. And you liken at one point to social dancing. Explain the similarity between social dancing and navigating the world with a guide dog.
So in social dance, your offhand is in your partner's hand, and you use tension between your hands back and forth with pressure to understand which way you're going. If somebody is pushing you forward, it means that with that hand, just gently, you can feel that tension so that you know which way to turn. It's the same thing with a guide dog. When your left hand is holding a harness, it is about the tension between the harness handle and your hand that tells you which way to go and how quickly to move and when you're allowed to walk and when you need to stop. If the harness goes slack in your hand, it's not useful. So a guide dog is very much like a dance partner. The guide dog is the lead. The blind person is the follow. And part of that is also giving over all of your trust to your guide dog in order to trust them to lead you. Same thing with a social dance partner. The difference is a social dance partner is on a dance floor, and they're just making sure you don't run into other dancers on the floor. Your guide dog is making sure you don't cross the street when it's a red light.
Finally, I want to have you, in this portion of our interview, say a word about learning Braille. And if I remember correctly, you very much regret that your first attempts to learn Braille came relatively late in life, and that it would have been so much simpler if Braille had been a part of your life, I mean, essentially from the outset. And I think for a lot of us, from the outside looking in, it's just inconceivable how one's fingertips can run across a series of those carefully placed bumps and actually be reading. I mean, it's just astonishing. What has your experience been with learning Braille, and particularly the circumstances under which you learned to read Braille?
So I am still learning Braille. It is a long process because my fingers, as you are pointing out, don't understand how to read yet. When you are younger, it is easier for your brain and your fingers and your body to pick up the idea that you're reading with your fingertips. As an adult, it's just a harder thing to pick up. At this point, I can read elevator buttons, which is very helpful because most elevators are very dark. I can read most bathroom signs and emergency exit signs because it's usually the same text. So I can sort of, if I find where it is, I understand what it's saying. But much like any other language, it's taking a lot of time and practice. I started learning Braille at guide dog school from one of my classmates, and the experience was a little bit like magic, if I'm being honest, because when you watch people who are fluently reading Braille, it is a little bit like a magic trick. fingers go over this. Their fingers just go over a series of bumps, and they know exactly what it says. And it's the same thing watching somebody explain how the cell system works with a bunch of playing cards, which is what she did. She just showed me, without looking at anything, what the cell looked like, and then she could go through the whole alphabet using the cards. And it was really, really magical, and it was also really important because it showed me just how much work I was going to have to do to become proficient at reading Braille. And I still am. It's not an easy skill to pick up, and I still really wish I had learned it much younger.
Right. My initial exposure to Braille came back in the late 1960s. We lived in a college town, and one of my mom's part-time jobs was to, I don't know what the word is, transcribe Braille, to create Braille for a blind student at the local college. And
she was a Brailler. Yeah, there's a name for that. She's a Brailler.
A Brailler, yes. And she did that only way back then. I don't know that that was something she ever did after that, but I still remember the kind of the device, but it was with a hand, little hand, looked like a small little pick, and that's how she would have to create this. And I remember being fascinated and wondering not only at the meticulous care with which she did that, but also what it would take to be able to read that and make sense of it. I mean, in some respects, it felt like magic or a miracle. I want to make sure that we take a couple of moments to talk about an interesting chapter in the book in which you talk about Helen Keller, and in particular talk about William Gibson, the author of The Miracle Worker, very loosely based on Helen Keller's own autobiography. If all that anybody knows about the deafblind experience is The Miracle Worker, then we are going to misunderstand a lot of things about Helen Keller. We don't have a lot of time, but could you just say a word about what you object to most in William Gibson's The Miracle Worker?
I think what I object to most is that Helen Keller doesn't have a voice in The Miracle Worker, and that it is a story that is about her without her inclusion. Helen Keller did have a voice. It was a very strong voice, and choosing to remove it undercut her own agency and her own life. And so that is the thing that I object to most. If you want to hear more about my thoughts on The Miracle Worker and Helen Keller, I did do the Helen Keller exorcism this year with Radiolab, which is a full hour-long episode about the legacy of Helen Keller.
And we can also direct people to the second chapter of your book, which explores this in great detail, and it is very, very intriguing reading. Of course, much of your book is about the world and about the ableist attitude of the world and the way in which it is created, and what you call the abled gaze, G-A-Z-E, the abled gaze with which you and others are viewed. I especially thought interesting the point when you talk about the English language, which you say is perniciously ableist. And of course, that is such a complication when it comes to, you know, well-meaning people maybe wanting to discuss or explore these issues, but with the imperfect tool of the English language at their disposal. What are the most serious ways in which the English language is, again, in your words, perniciously ableist?
We use so much of disability as something to metaphorize as negative. So people will say, oh, well, it fell on deaf ears, or they were blind to their faults, or there's multitudes of these. They're all metaphors that use disability in order to tell us that something is bad. And what that does is it associates for people over and over again that being disabled is a bad thing, or that it's a negative. And so we don't have any positive connotations for disability in our language. And I see that, and I feel that, especially as a writer and an editor. But I also feel that as an actual person. Like, my own language does not see any positivity in the life that I lead. So I have to create that positivity for myself.
What about the world and making the world, in a sense, more accessible. I mean, certainly some ground has been gained in this, but certainly not enough. And there are still probably some very serious misunderstandings about the kind of things that could and should be done. What would be a couple of them to which you would draw our attention?
The first is that I would say we need ASL to be a language that people learn. Hearing people need to learn it just as much as deaf people do, because otherwise hearing people can't necessarily interact with deaf people. We also need to change our employment laws. So many companies use biased language to turn disabled people away at the door, with things like you have to be able to lift 50 pounds in order to do this job at a job that has nothing to do with lifting and carrying things. And these little things add up to really big things. So I think it's about looking around and seeing what little things you find that are ableist in your own corner of the world and then taking them apart. It's an opportunity to say, well, if my kid's school is, you know, assigning the miracle worker, maybe talk to the teacher and find out if there is something else that they can read about disability instead. Because we can change the way that we see disability, but the only way that we do that is by actually making changes.
I want to return to something you said early in the interview, something about people in your life seeing you as not disabled, and saying that, thinking that they were giving you a compliment. You write at one point, people say to me all of the time, I don't think of you as deaf, blind, disabled. And you write, then I feel like they don't see me at all. And I think you're reading those words, that will you know, maybe come as something of a shock. And then, but we just ponder that and realize how true that surely is. How do you want people then to see you?
I want people to see me as a deaf, blind woman who's competent. That means that I want them to treat me like an adult, not like a child, which happens a lot. I want people to see me as a competent parent, because that's also true. And I want people to see me as someone who can work, who can tell stories. I want people to see me as somebody who is capable. I just want to be seen as a person. And I think that when people fail to see my disabilities, what they're failing to see is my whole personhood. If you look at me and you try to reduce me to somebody who might have a disabled body, but we're trying not to see it, what you're really saying is, I don't want to see your disability, and I don't want to see what your experience is really like. So please, do look at the disability. Please look at the disability as part of my body, not like something that's a freak show or something to be on display, but as a whole part of my personhood.
As you write early on, I ended up forging my own path to adulthood with a disability. And certainly part of that life's journey is the writing of this really, really important book, again, about to be re-released in paperback. The title, Being Seen, One Deaf Blind Woman's Fight to End Ableism, published by Simon Element and the author Elsa Hunnison. Elsa Hunnison, thank you so much, first of all, for giving the world this really important book, and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I enjoyed this so much. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so very much for having me. It was definitely clear that you've read the book, and I really appreciate having a thorough conversation about it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I speak with Dr. Deborah Ford, Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We'll talk about this new academic school year that is just underway, and we'll talk about some exciting campus renovations that have been taking place over the last few months. Wednesday, I'll be speaking with the author of a new book called Passion Plays, which examines the connection between religion and professional team sports here in the United States. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program to talk about an array of current events and issues. And on Friday, from the archives, Mark Freeman's wonderful book about one of the most important sitcoms in recent television history, Modern Family. His wonderful oral history includes reminiscences from every cast member and many of the people involved behind the scenes in creating this marvelous show.